Well, thank you very much, Jan, and thank you very much to the Society for inviting me to give this lecture. I probably wouldn't be standing here at all if it hadn't been the interest that the textbook Buckman and Brady gave me as an undergraduate student when I started my career in the UK too long ago, almost to remember now. And I certainly enjoyed reading that book, and it stimulated my interest in soil science. But I also have a confession to make to you. Not only am I really a lapsed soil scientist, because I've moved more into the area of water, I'm also a lapsed member of the Society, so I was very, very appreciative of you actually forgetting that and inviting me to present to you today. My title is Feeding 9 Billion People, A Critical Challenge for Agricultural Science. We've all just had a very hearty breakfast, a lot of fruit, vitamins, protein, but I think I'd just like you to reflect that for probably a billion people in the world, they don't have the luxury of eating at all in the day, probably just as we've eaten for breakfast. So my career has very much been driven in the last 10 years or so by looking at how we can improve the prospects for feeding an ever-growing population around the globe. I want to really talk about this in the context of the challenge of doing that. I'll talk about a paradox of food and water. I want to look at the drivers of what we can call food insecurity, but also of water insecurity. Look at some of the critical land and water issues. I am trying to come back a little bit to the soil science side to balance that, because my own belief is that we are not going to solve many of these substantial challenges facing humanity unless we integrate across a wide range of disciplines. I'll be also looking at a few scenarios, and these are just scenarios. I can't tell you whether they're going to come true, time will tell, and to look at some of the potential solutions in dealing with this major challenge. I talked about a paradox. This is a global food and water, but I've readdressed this as a natural resources paradox because I believe it is. And that paradox is that we've got to feed 2 billion more people with less land and water for agriculture than we have now in an area of climate change. And I'll explain why we're going to have to feed more with less as I go through the talk. I also want to point out that there are really two absolutely fundamentally strong drivers of change, and these are the growing population around the globe, and not only growing population but the growing wealth of many developing countries. And we're looking at these two drivers in the context of climate change creating uncertainty. If we have a look at what's happened to population statistics, global gross domestic product, and water withdrawals between 1900 and 2000, we get a pretty interesting picture. On the left, we see world population and GDP, and we can see that population increase has been about 3.6 times in that century. But if we look at that in terms of water withdrawals, that's twice as much, almost 6.8 times on the right-hand side. And we can see there that agriculture has been the primary driver of increased water withdrawals. But if we look at GDP, that's much greater. It's been about 3% per year at constant prices, according to the IMF. And that is that red line on the left-hand graph. So population growing significantly, GDP also growing well, almost exponentially in that particular diagram. If we look at how we've dealt with these challenges to date, we can see there's been really since the beginning of the Green Revolution, around about the late 50s, early 60s, in which Norman Borlaug played such a critical role, we've seen a very major increase in World Bank and other lending for irrigation schemes, peaking through the sort of 70s and into the mid-80s, but still quite substantial developments since then. If we look at irrigated area, that's of course gone up, so this has been one of the critical reasons how we have managed to increase food production to date. If we look at the food price index, after the fuel-driven or the energy-driven spike in the mid-early 70s, we see there's been a general decline in food prices through that period up to about 2000. But if we look at what's happened since 2000, it's been on a steadily upward trend, and I'll show that in more detail in a moment. But although we've tackled the problem of trying to produce more food and done that very successfully, and to the extent we don't see anything like as many famines as we saw in the 50s and 60s, it's been at a cost. And one way of looking at that cost, there are many, but one way is looking at this Living Planet Index of Freshwater Species, which has been in steady decline through the period up to 2000 and has continued to flatline or decrease slightly since that period. So some major successes, but also coming at considerable cost to the environment. The statistics demonstrate that there has been a significant growing demand for food here, measured in on the right in terms of changes in kilocalories per person per day in a percentage level. And we can see virtually all the regions of the world on this upward increase. So not only is the population increasing, but there are demand for and a calorific intake has also increased on a per person basis. And one of the reasons why this is happening is related strongly to GDP. This is some older data, I think, that IMI put together some years ago, which shows along the bottom GDP per capita in 2000 constant dollars, and on the left, on the y-axis, the consumption of meat. And here we can see we've got the USA as a yardstick, not necessarily a good yardstick, up on the top right. But we can see that meat consumption in China in particular has increased quite dramatically. And that pattern is repeated in a number of developing countries as people have more money to spend in their pockets. India is a little different in that it's predominantly a vegetarian society. But if then we look at milk, which is a very important product in India, we can see that milk consumption in India has been decreasing quite dramatically, and these trends are continuing to the current day. Why is this important? Well, as I think most of you are aware, it takes a lot more water and often more land to produce meat and dairy products than it does to produce cereals and other vegetables. So again, this is one of these instances where GDP, growing wealth, is increasing the need for water, for food, which requires more water and often more land. I mentioned the food price index and how that has increased. When I started my term at IMI, we'd just seen, we were just in the middle of the, I suppose what we can call the most recent world food crisis, in that it was a market-driven crisis. Prices were spiralling, and at the same time we were seeing food riots in a number of countries, particularly Egypt, but also in several countries in South Asia, where the poor just didn't have enough money to buy the food and went out on the streets in protest. We subsequently saw a decline in food prices after that that then crisis declined. But again, we've seen an increase in prices around about 2011, and the general level has stayed higher than it that has been any other time in the last 100 years. The 2007-2008 food crisis was precipitated by a number of factors, and this is the kind of where a number of factors come together to form a kind of perfect storm. In that case, it was in particular China moving into the grains market in a big way. At IMI at the time, we'd done some work pointing out that they were starting to produce a lot of energy, bioenergy, from crops which had previously been used for food. They actually went to the trouble of writing to us and refuting what we were saying at the time, and this was also said by other agencies such as the International Food Policy Research Institute, but very shortly after that, I think they realised what was happening and went into the market in a big way. That coincided with a number of droughts around the world, one in Australia where the wheat crop was much, much lower, and as a consequence, prices just started to move up, with the consequence of the poor suffering around the world, particularly because then many governments put in place rather foolish policy responses which stopped export, for example, in India, when India had plenty of food. So we get a chain of events tied to one or two driving factors. If we turn to sort of looking at what's happened to land, I'm indebted to an ex-colleague, Neil McKenzie, for sending me some of this information. We're seeing a tremendous amount of land being swallowed up by urbanisation. In China, for example, about 44,000 square kilometres have been lost from 2000 to 2010. And this trend is moving on inexorably in China. In the EU, between 1900 and 2000, about 275 hectares per day of soil have been lost in the EU, amounting to a total of 1,000 square kilometres a year. Now, half of this is being sealed under asphalt and concrete. And as you can see there, this means every 10 years, an area at least the size of Cyprus is being paved over. Rates have declined slightly recently, but this is still a serious problem. Often, because as many of you are aware, some of these areas are adjacent to major cities. These major cities were set up usually in areas where there was good agricultural hinterland. So some of our best agricultural soils are being covered with concrete and asphalt and replaced with housing and factories. And I think this is something we still need to be concerned about as we move forward in all countries around the globe. And we've seen in the last few years at least the amount of change in area in cropland and pasture land has flattened off, and in terms of pasture has got less because of consumption of this land by other uses, in some cases by policy responses to EU and other US policy. Soils themselves are under great pressure. This is a rather poor slide in terms of what we're going to hear about in the conference over the next 3 days. There'll be a lot more detail, and I apologise that I haven't got time to go into a great amount of detail. But so, the soil profile, which is the basis of most of our food production, is being impacted by all these factors that I've mentioned previously, by climate change adaptation and mitigation processes, urban expansion, the demands on it for increasing more from the same resource, looking at it, water storage and provision, green water, which falls on the land, is stored in the soil, so that's a vital sort of input into agriculture, being put under pressure by energy production, and so on and so on. And we see the ongoing scourge of land degradation, although it's been tackled to some extent in some areas very successfully, such as in the parts of the US and parts of Australia, but in many countries this is still going on. And it's marked by things like irrigation and dryland salinity, soil structural decline, significant soil fertility losses, continuing water and wind erosion, and in some cases soil acidification, partially caused in some cases by acid rain, and caused in others by legume rotation, as in my own country in Australia. If we turn to water, given that water is going to be one of the driving forces of agriculture, by 2000 we realised that water was already under very significant stress and becoming scarce. The diagram on the left shows the areas, two areas of water scarcity. The areas in the brownish-orange colours are those which are physically water scarce. By that we mean that usually about 75% of the total available water resources are already being used for abstractive uses, and limited amounts are left for environmental purposes. And in the areas in the bluer purple colours, these are areas which were economically water scarce. And by that we mean there just hasn't been enough investment in the water resource to deliver that resource to the users, whether it's agriculture, industry or domestic. And we can see there that physically scarce areas include part of the southwest of the US, much of the Middle East, large parts of India, northern China, and the Murray-Darling Basin, for example, in Australia. And on the right-hand side, that shows the areas where environmental water requirements may not be met under current usage regimes. So again, they mirror to a large extent those physically water stressed areas. Excuse me. As I'll point out later, this is going to be a very significant factor in terms of looking at how we can manage to produce more food with less environmental damage. I want to turn now to a few scenarios that a colleague and myself and I looked at in terms of modelling future water supplies for agriculture and other uses. We used a water sim model which was developed by IMI and IFPRI's impact model, which looked at food demand. And we ran this model for 125 river basins and 115 economic areas around the world. We looked at scenarios of where we had existing trade levels or where trade and commodities was enhanced over 2010 levels. And we picked three scenarios, just to give us a range of future possibilities, and I stress these are possibilities, they're not predictions per se. We looked at business as usual, where population growth was going to be about 50%, GDP growth about 365%, and we looked at an optimistic scenario where population growth was slowing, as we are told may happen towards the mid part of this and latter part of this century, but under that scenario the indicator suggested that GDP would be growing more rapidly. And we looked at a pessimistic scenario where we hadn't got a control on population growth, but GDP growth was lower. And these three diagrams just show you the different scenarios, and they're overlaid one on another. That is the pessimistic scenario of population change. That's the business as usual. And that's the optimistic scenario. So the optimistic scenario, just to remind you, has less growth in population. If we look at GDP, this was the pessimistic scenario, which has the least amount of GDP, but notice that that's quite significant in parts of the Middle East and Africa. As we move into business as usual, India, but much of Africa gets higher growth in GDP, and under the optimistic scenario, we see many countries in Africa and elsewhere, Southeast Asia, taking off quite rapidly. And when we produced those modelling outcomes on a global basis for, in this case, domestic, industrial, livestock and irrigation demand, we can see that under the optimistic scenario on the right-hand side, right-hand top, we see that demand for water consumption goes up to something in the order of 7,000 cubic kilometres per annum. And I'll come to the significance of that in a moment. Under the pessimistic scenario, it is much lower. But the other key point I want to draw to your attention is that if we look at irrigation demand on the top right, that stays very much the same as we move up through the years. And we see a very big growth in industrial and domestic demand. In terms of the way the model was configured, this is because the absolute water supply is limited to what is coming in through rainfall and in storage, and we made the assumptions that particularly domestic and industrial demand were probably going to take precedence over over agricultural water demand, as usually is the case, particularly for domestic. So this is quite a worrying scenario in that agriculture is unlikely to be able to increase its share of this blue water, the irrigation water, under those kind of future conditions. Now, to put this in context, we're looking here at how much water is withdrawn in 2000. And I put that green line there, sloping slightly up, because that will increase as we go through time, as some undeveloped water resources are developed. But it's about 4,000 cubic kilometres of water per year. This is withdrawals. Withdrawals and consumption are slightly different. Consumptive demand is always less than water withdrawals due to irrigation inefficiency. But as you can see, by close to 2030, we're starting to see a scenario under this optimistic scenario where there is more demand for water than there is water available. And if we drill down into a number of regions, we can see exactly where that's going to happen. McKinsey's made a big report about 3 years ago from the Water Resources 2030 group, which demonstrated, for example, that India was going to have demand which could be 50% above actual supply by 2030. We're already seeing this happening in northeast China, and we've seen the response there, the Three Gorges Dam, with the movement of vast amounts of water from the Yangtze northwards to the North China Plain. However, as I said, these are just scenarios, and if you look at some of Peter Gleick's work from the Pacific Institute, he's plotted here a number of potential scenarios come up by various individuals against historical water withdrawals. And you can see in the pre-1980 period, we saw very, very optimistic, or if you like, pessimistic increases for demand in water, which were then reduced somewhat as we came through the current period. So where we actually move to depends very much on how we recognise the problem and the type of responses, both in terms of policy, but also in terms of productivity and efficiency gains that we put in place to deal with these scenarios. I just wanted to touch on climate change impacts. This is not particularly sophisticated modelling, but my colleague and I, Aditya Sood, looked at this at a global level, just taking a couple of the IPCC middle-of-the-road scenarios to try and estimate to what extent increasing potential evapotranspiration, which is dependent obviously on temperature increases, what impact that was going to have on precipitation, on water availability. We also looked at global rainfall, and like many others, we found no, in the modelling we were doing and the information we had at hand from the IPCC, global rainfall is pretty much all over the place, little clear trend. Some places will get drier, some are going to get more rain. Distribution and intensity may change, which may cause us big problems in agriculture. But when we looked at global PET, we saw an increase of evapotranspiration, as you would expect, due to these higher temperatures. Now, whether that's 1 degree, 2 degrees or more, we don't know, but depending on what measures are put in place. But what it meant from our point of view was that the gap between potential evapotranspiration and effective rainfall will be about 17% higher than the baseline for this particular A2 climate scenario and 14% higher than the B1 climate change scenario. What this means is it's going to put even more pressure on demand for irrigation water, because there will be less water there. And then if we look at temperature, we see quite significant impacts from temperature. This is predicted wheat yield in India. And what's happening here is that, and this is work from CIMIT, what's happening here is that increases in night temperature as we get into warming conditions are going to make conditions much less suitable for wheat and reduce the areas where wheat can be where it can be grown in India, and the consequent yields, with a 10% yield increase potential loss for every degree C increase in temperature. Similarly, if we look at predictions for Africa from IFPRI, we see that whilst one or two crops, millet and sorghum, for example, may have a beneficial impact from climate change, most of the modelling is suggesting that things like wheat, sweet potato and yam, cassava, maize and rice will see decreases in yield due to climate change impacts. So we're seeing a number of negative factors in terms of natural resources, in terms of water availability, increasing potential evapotranspiration. We have to ask, where is the extra water and production going to come from? Well, one answer is that rain-fed agriculture will have to expand. But then if we go back to that issue of showed earlier of available land, there aren't too many areas with a lot of extra available land. There may be parts of the US, parts of Canada, particularly if climate change makes more northern environments more suitable. There may be parts of the Ukraine and Russia where there are some opportunities. But in many countries in Southeast Asia, South Asia, there just isn't land left for expansion. So that tends to push the argument we're going to have to really look at increasing productivity rather than expanding in area. So the last few slides that I want to talk about is how can we respond to this paradox of having to grow more with maybe less natural resource base to do it on under those driving influences of population, GDP and climate. And one thing is to really look at taking the lessons from countries like the US, Europe and Australia into the developing world to really increase productivity. There are some great potential increases that we can look at there still. We can also look at building resilience in terms of water storage. One of the things that has intrigued me is if we look at Africa, water storage levels in most countries are very, very low. They're in the order of 30 to 100 cubic metres of water stored per person. In the US, they're up near 5,000 cubic metres of water stored per person. A tremendous difference. We can encourage free trade of food commodities. This is very important, so where we can produce food cheaply, we can produce it, we can trade it, and into countries where they can conserve their water, which is rare, for other uses such as urban and industrial. We can move much more into recycling and reuse of both solids and wastewater in terms of the fertiliser and water chains. We can particularly reduce food waste, and I'll come to some examples of that. And we can enhance supply chains so we can benefit farmers, consumers and the environment. A lot of work to be done there. At the same time, we can, whilst we're doing all this increase of productivity and efficiency in agriculture, we need to make sure that from the water perspective, that that same thing is going on in terms of industrial and urban water use. But it's very important to stress the fact that all the above require a very sound R&D basis, and they improve, and they need improving frameworks for water and land reform, which relate to policy, governance, institutions, and regulation. And it's important to point out that many of you may think in the US it's over-regulated, but in many countries in the developing world there are very limited policies and very little regulation, and very much a free-for-all, which is not helping. At the same time, we've got to do this in an environmentally sustainable manner, so we don't see further declines in things like the Global Fresh Water Index. So, for example, if we look at increasing productivity, this is a rather squiggly looking graph, but it's quite a neat concept developed by a colleague of mine, Simon Cook, which shows cereal production per area on the y-axis against area of land used in the x-axis. And we can see that the number of countries are going vertically, which is a good thing, that they're growing more without an increase in area. So this is the reality of improving productivity. One area, which is sub-Saharan Africa, is still going horizontally. So the Africa, which is going to have some big GDP growth and big population growth, is certainly going to need to change that line from the horizontal to the vertical, to emulate countries like Vietnam and China. So great potential in increasing productivity in some areas. As I said, rethinking water storage in terms of water for agriculture, and this isn't just large-scale dams and reservoirs. It really goes through the whole gamut of looking at small village ponds, groundwater storage, water harvesting, and improved soil moisture storage, as well as virtual storage through food, having food stores available to meet periods of a famine. Particularly in Africa, renewed interest in storage infrastructure for irrigation. We need to be looking at diversity within river basins. We need to be looking at multiple use storages, not just for hydro, but for hydro and irrigation. Trade is going to be vital. We need to be trying to remove barriers to trade so that goods can flow more freely, and so we don't see perverse policies being put in place in periods of food crisis or shortage. That's just showing some of the current trade. That can be enhanced quite significantly if we remove certain barriers. And it would certainly benefit a number of countries in the developing world. Recycling and reuse. One of the interesting things I learned when I started my job at IMI was that about 700 million people eat vegetables which are grown on what's called grey or black water, that's largely untreated water. These come from peri-urban agricultural areas. There's a great risk involved in this. In fact, someone from the University of California wrote to us and said this was shocking, but it's reality. And one of the things we have to be doing is really looking at how we can make these systems safer and cheaper. And one of the things that IMI was doing, or is doing, is very much looking at business models which are going to promote reuse of solid and liquid wastes in a safe and sustainable fashion. And there is really great scope there to do this right across the developing world, but also to some extent in some developed countries. We can eat a healthier diet. We see a situation around the world where we have increases, very significant increases in overeating and obesity and the diseases which go with obesity. At the same time, we still see something like 1 billion people who are undernourished. So we have a problem with two ends here, a polarized problem. And one way we can deal with it is trying to start to deal with the end where people are eating too much. And one of these critical issues is the amount of meat it is being eaten. And as I mentioned earlier, meat is going to produce, meat requires a very much significant more amount of water to produce and land. And although I'm not advocating we go down completely to the healthy diet level, this was a level put up by some doctors in The Lancet recently, which said we can all survive quite happily on about 90 grams of meat per day, instead of the 224 or 280 there, which are projected as going to be required. So there's some opportunity there. We can also reduce food waste. Food waste comes from two significant areas. One is inadequate storage, transport, and marketing access in the developing world. So a lot of food rots or is eaten by rodents or insects. But also, we can reduce waste at the point of consumption. And in 2010, I think this is European figures, I think it's higher in the US and higher in Australia, individually we threw away 179 kilograms of food per year. You know, that is a shocking amount of waste. It's symptomized in that diagram, and it's one thing we can deal with every one and individual of us if we sort of look at shopping more frugally and not wasting as much food. I think if we go back to that, I thought I might have had it on, yeah, one of the, yes, on that diagram there. We could save about 1,350 cubic kilometres of water going into agriculture if we could reduce losses by about 50%. So that's throwing away less and saving more when we're producing it through better storage, etc., in the developing world at least, can save a very, very significant amount of that water which is going to be required to grow more food in the future. And again, just looking at that diagram from Jan Lundquist in Siwi, we can significantly reduce the amount of calories required by looking at post-harvest losses and reducing waste, so we can come down to this 2,000 kilocalorie per day per person requirement. So coming to some conclusions, it's since the 2007-2008 food crisis, food and agriculture and association management of water have become very much more significant in the thinking of many bureaucrats, policymakers right around the world. In 2000 to 2005, agriculture was considered by many policymakers almost a sunset industry. We were all going to sort of move into a blue skies future based on high tech. And in some ways it was very fortunate that the 2007-2008 food crisis came to bite us, but it made us realise that we're going to get in trouble again in terms of food availability unless we do something about it. The key drivers, as I've said, are population and GDP, but we need to look at a number of other factors relating to global change. Climate change, very important, but also energy. And one of the reasons why energy is so important, a lot of water which may go into food production has been moving into biofuels and has been moving into cooling for thermal power plants in countries like China and elsewhere. So there is really a food, water, energy nexus which we need to deal with in an integral fashion. Science does indicate that we can feed more people, but I think the most critical factor is really we need to look at some of these methods where we can sustainably intensify agriculture, and that's going to require renewed investment in R&D, but not only in R&D, in capacity building, in land and water reform, so that we can do all this without irreparable environmental damage, or further irreparable environmental damage. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much.